皆さんこんにちは。オフトピックの宮武哲郎です。
DCM の原です。
DGP のエムレです。
はい、今日はちょっと特別会
スペシャルですね。はい、
ところで、原さんのバックグラウンドが
もうバナナ、
ちょっとバナナがあるんですけど、
はい、なぜバナナ
哲郎さんお願いします。
はい、今日は、ちょっと、久しぶりのゲスト会をやるんですけど、ちょっとゲストが日本人ではないので、今回ちょっと英語で、ちょっとインタビューを、させて、いただきますと。で、今日のゲストが、バナナキャピタルのターナー・ノバックさんなんですけど、ターナー・ノバックさん、は、僕も、多分 1年ちょっと前ぐらいに知り合った、VC で、まあ、その前からずっとツイッターですごいアクティブで、それこそ多分エムレさんも原さんも、はい、トラッキングをしてたと。
そうですね、大好きなアカウントです。
そうですよね。うん、そのミームアカウントで。
毎日見るんじゃないかなって。
毎日見る。超有名アカウント。
なんで、まあ、彼が、まあ、いろいろ知り合いが、共通の知り合いもいて、で、まあ、今回ちょっとポッドキャストに出てくれるというところで、アメリカの、まあ、VC 業界だったり、まあ、ちょっと彼のバックグラウンドだったり、彼が、まあ、今、ちょうど、2号ファンド、を、立ち上げたところだったりするので、まあ、そこでちょっと、出てくれるっていう、ところなので、ちょっとここからはちょっと英語、の回になるので、まあ、ちょっとまた別途なんか日本語の解説会とか、なんかそういうのがあるかもしれないのと、あと一応 YouTube 版ですと、字幕は入れるので、もし、この回を、見たく、で、そのまあ日本語で見たければ、YouTube を、見てくださいと。はい、じゃあ早速始めましょうか。
はい。
All right, Turner. It's great having you. Sorry, the intro was all in Japanese. but yeah, so, you know, we have a special guest here today, Turner Novak from Banana Capital. Turner and I think, known each other for a little over a year now, I want to say. Maybe yeah. Something around there. And then I first heard of you through Twitter. I think all of us have.
Yeah,
as,
definitely.
As
yes.
I think most VCs in the world have. and, you know, for me, it was, I think, the Fantasy VC Portfolio.
That's a long time ago.
2020? 2019? Something around there, right?
Yeah, I think it was 2018.
Oh, was it 2018?
2018,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so and then obviously your memes are everywhere. So it's great having you on. You know, all of us are fans here. Yeah. So Turner, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, thank you so much. Us.
Thanks for joining.
You're coming in from Michigan.
Yep.
Awesome. And can you give a quick kind of intro about yourself and then about Banana Capital?
Yeah, my name's Turner Novak. The fund I run is called Banana Capital. We invest in mostly consumer-facing products. So I used to describe this as Web 2. It was basically just non-crypto consumer-facing and then like bottoms-up software. Mm-hmm. So on the consumer side, we do a lot of e-commerce, a little bit of fintech, and then all these things, it's a little bit of healthcare, education, kind of fascinated by things like climate, housing, haven't done a whole lot there yet. But it's basically just solving problems for consumers, leveraging the internet and software. And then on the enterprise side, we do like bottoms up vertical SaaS type stuff, vertical dev tools, which I don't know if is actually a category yet, but it's kind of developer tools focused on certain use cases or industries. And then a little bit of B2B marketplaces. And we're kind of trying to get a little bit more in the zone on slightly more deeper tech, true venture type stuff. But I'm pretty slow on diving into new categories. It's kind of, I slowly like to learn about them. So we typically write 250 to, we've gone up to $10 million checks, but those are generally when we follow on raising one-off SPVs. But kind of the sweet spot is 250, 500K USD, US dollar checks, pre-seed and seed rounds. And so it's like the first or second round. Generally, valuation that's 20 million or below, kind of in that first check, prefer to invest as early as possible. And sometimes we'll invest a little bit higher. And kind of the threshold we think through is, this, could this be a publicly traded company? That's kind of the thing that we try and answer, because it's kind of what we're trying to do in venture. Invest super early in, you know, world-changing companies that will know, impact a lot of people, solve a lot of problems, and make a lot of money for investors. And, you know, we all know how VC works. It's, you know, you're usually wrong. So that's why we try to invest as early as possible, because we can be wrong a lot. And hopefully it all works out. We make enough money for our investors and everyone's really happy. And us, the founders, all that stuff. So.
And then it's not just the US, right? Although I think most of your portfolio is in the US.
Yeah, so it's probably about 60% is in North America. Mm-hmm. And it's just a function of being on the internet. I'll meet someone who's, you know, leading Facebook in Latin America, like all the products, Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, Messenger, leaves to start a new company. They follow me on Twitter. They've read some of my stuff. They just DM me and I end up investing. And I probably would miss out on that if I was only investing in Michigan-based founders here in the U.S. There's definitely some smart people here,
right?
Just being on the internet, it's kind of like, you know, I have a lot of opportunities because of, you know, what we've done over, or what I've done over the years, and it would almost be like I just kind of cut some of them off. Like it's, you know, you're kind of limiting yourself. So I'm just kind of trying to play the game that and play on the field that's in front of me, and just kind of take advantage of all the opportunities. So and we're not really super heavy on any one category, sector, region, market, etc. It's fairly diversified. But like I said, if anything, I'd say it probably just tilts consumer. So consumer, like internet and software.
Mm-hmm. Right. Which is, I think, your kind of bread and butter personally as well. And let's talk about this, because Michigan has been mentioned a few times now. You started as a VC in Michigan, which is pretty much unheard of.
it's probably dumb. Like, I just should have moved to San Francisco.
Not quite known for tech hub.
I mean, there are good universities there, right? And they have a great like self-driving program, like all like great engineers coming out of there. So there is somewhat of a tech scene, but it's obviously not nearly, you know, Silicon Valley, New York, Austin, Miami, wherever, you know, the tech hubs are now. Talk about, you know, how you got from Michigan to kind of breaking in here, and then how difficult was it to actually break in?
How difficult? It was extremely hard. It took a lot longer than I thought it would. It also probably took longer because I didn't just move to San Francisco. I mean, honestly,
but was this planned though? Like when you were in Michigan, you're like, okay, I'm gonna break into VC. This is how I'm gonna do it, and it's gonna take whatever, like 3 months, 1 year, 2 years, and then you executed that. Is that essentially what happened?
Yeah, it was probably, if I think about when it kind of was a just continuation of learning about investing and how to be a good investor. And I, you know, you learn about stocks and you learn how they work. There's a company behind them. You need to figure out what the companies do. You need to understand their financials, what drives the performance of the stock. And then you start looking, you go like, man, why didn't I invest in this company earlier? You know, there's an IPO, you can invest before the IPO. And then I kind of learned what venture capital was. It's like, oh, you can invest in Facebook, Uber, Mercari when they're a startup, and the returns are even better. So I just kind of went down that rabbit hole, just the journey of learning about investing. And I'd kind of always been a nerd, spent a lot of time on the internet, played a lot of video games as a kid. So when I kind of, it all clicked for me, it was like, wow, there's this thing where you can, it combines business and the internet and investing and meeting new people. And it's kind of like playing a video game, right? Like it's investing. You're kind of always just, your score is the returns that you generate. Like it's just kind of never ending. So
it's just hard to track the scores in venture capital versus public markets, where the stock price is always there.
Yeah, you can sort of track it, but it's not the same, and there's a lot of false indicators that don't actually mean anything, and that are probably, you know, the wrong things to follow and track, or they're the right things to follow for a while, but then they end up not being the right things. So yeah, it just kind of started. I had this realization of what it was. I was like, man, that's what I want to do. I need to figure out how to do it. I was working at an endowment in the US at the time in Michigan. And I just started writing online. Initially, it was more serious things. Kind of the example that I gave, the first things I really started tweeting about was, this was when Snap had gone public. They owned Snapchat. And people, the first thing I really tweeted about was they redesigned their app, which was a huge deal. People hated it. Kylie Jenner, who's a big, like the most followed person on Instagram, on social media, came out and said she doesn't use the app anymore. Mm-hmm. It was basically the next MySpace. Like people thought it was going bankrupt. Mm-hmm. And I think if you just look at the data, like their public filings with the SEC, like that wasn't, I didn't think that was true. So they basically had, they had a pretty similar size user base as Instagram, mm-hmm. which is owned by Facebook in the US and Europe. It's a little bit smaller, but it's similar sized, same monetization strategy. Mm-hmm. It was just a little bit further, a couple of years behind. And it was trading at like $5 billion, I think, at the low point. And analysts were saying Instagram was worth somewhere between 200 and 500 billion. Mm-hmm. And just the disconnect, that alone didn't make sense to me. And then mm-hmm. they made all these changes to the product that I actually thought were going to be good on the business side. They were adding new ad inventory. They're adding a bunch of new like growth loops to like grow the product. They were redesigning their app so it actually worked on Android. It used to only work on iOS. So it opened up a bunch of new markets and then also new users in the US and Europe. And I kind of started laying these things out there and met a bunch of people. I did this fantasy VC portfolio where it was basically, if you've ever done fantasy sports. So I
talk about fantasy sports because that's not a thing here.
So you almost have a fake team. So mm-hmm. let's say baseball, soccer, you pick some players and you get points based on how the players perform in the game. So they get a hit, home run, RBI, or they get a goal, they get an assist. And you compete against other people who are doing the same thing every week. There's playoffs, mm-hmm. there's a championship. So you kind of have a fake team. And I kind of took the concept to startup investing. And this is actually a kind of a common thing in public stocks where you have a fake $1 million mm-hmm. and you can fake mm-hmm. own the stocks and basically learn how to invest, lose a lot mm-hmm. of money without actually losing $1 million. So that's basically what I did with startups. I was just like, okay, I'm going to pretend I'm a VC. I actually pretended I had $10 million and I realized mm-hmm. that was the worst. That was not a good way to start. So I kind of went back and was like, actually, let's divide everything by 10. I'm going to have a million instead of 10 million because that doesn't make it. That's how little I knew about what I was doing. I kind of did this fantasy portfolio and just, you know, fake invested in some startups.
What companies were in the fake portfolio?
So probably the best one, it's a company called Superhuman. It's like a mm-hmm. high-end luxury email. You mm-hmm. pay $30 a month and it makes you faster at your email. Mm-hmm. Yep. Everyone's nodding their heads. Like it's kind of a ridiculous product, but it's it works. Like it's helpful. Another one it's this company, it's called WeCare. It's sort of like Airbnb, mm-hmm. but for daycare. It's like running daycare out of homes. They run software to like run a business in a box. So you can run a daycare from your house. And then they started getting into B2B. So that now they, if you're, let's say you're Toyota and you want to provide childcare benefits to all your employees and you have people all over the country, basically WeCare can instantly spin up daycares all around and they can introduce supply anywhere in the country so that any employee can have daycare for their kid. I'm exaggerating that a little bit, but that's essentially how it worked. So I just picked some startups that I had no idea how they were doing. Like I had no data. Mm-hmm. I was basically just Googling Reddit, watching YouTube videos and interviews with the founders. One of them, I found WeCare, actually the childcare one, I found her pitch to an accelerator that she applied to. I found it on like the third page of Google. And that's mm-hmm. That's kind of how I did a bunch of research on that one. And then, just put it out there publicly, kind of tracked it. Again, I didn't really know what I was doing, so it wasn't a perfect process, but just kind of used it to start meeting people. That so the fantasy portfolio combined with just tweeting other things. So I was kind of doing on one end of the spectrum, it was startups, and at the very end of the startup, it was like publicly traded companies. I kind of was just talking about the whole spectrum. Not a lot of people, and it probably took about 2 years of just sharing my thoughts. Wow. I was married with one kid at the time. So that's why I did not move to San Francisco. I had no money. Like, I mean, I probably had $2,000 in my bank account, like average at any one of these times. So it was, if I wanted to go to San Francisco, I had to take a couple days off of work, vacation days. Right. All my savings was going to San Francisco. I mean, I stayed with friends, like crashed at their places, tried to make the trips as cheap as possible. And then ended up taking an internship at a pre-seed fund was kind of, and the only reason I took it, it was on paper, probably the worst financial monetary offer It was about an 80% pay cut, but they were open to me working remote. So I kind of, I became an intern again. I was 27 or 28.
And you had a full-time job before that.
Yep. Yeah, I was working as an LP in an endowment in the U.S.,
right,
which is a good job. I think being an LP at a large, you know, asset allocator is probably one of the best, one of the best jobs in the world, honestly.
What, where was that endowment investing in VC funds as well? Is that how you kind of got to know about the industry there?
Yeah, a little bit. We invested across every asset class. We were all generalists, and I was kind of the low man on the totem pole. I was just the analyst, made all the spreadsheets, took all the notes. Just helped with whatever the analyst on the team helped with. It wasn't glamorous. I'm not trying to pretend I was like, you know, some hotshot. But I started studying for the CFA exams. I don't know if that's a common thing in Japan. So I passed the first two levels. And that was when I realized I didn't want to be an LP. I really wanted to do venture full time. Then I got this internship, and it was a short-term thing. I was losing so much money. I was barely making enough. So I couldn't actually afford my mortgage payment anymore. So we sold the house that we lived in. Then I also had a rental property that I'd bought a couple of years ago, because in Michigan, you can buy, I bought the house for like, I had about $3,000 that I put down. I saved up tax refunds. Like that's how I bought the house. And it was a great property, like insane margins. Like if I would walk through all the numbers, it was insane. I did not want to sell it. Sold it, and we had to move. So we moved to Ann Arbor, just across Michigan. We lived on the west side, now we live on the east side. Ann Arbor's kind of by Detroit, sort of by Toronto. It's kind of maybe like 10 hours from New York, about 4 hours from Chicago, 3 hours from Chicago. And then met some real estate guys that were looking to kind of start investing in venture. So teamed up with them. And that's kind of how I did it. It probably would have been easier to just move to San Francisco, get a job at a normal fund, like do all the normal things everyone does, go back to school, get an MBA, get in that way. But I didn't really have a choice, just because married with a kid, had no money, I wasn't really set up to make those decisions. Right. So,
Yeah.
I think from there, I think you started Banana Capital in 2021, and you build your brand and presence in such a very short time, very quickly, very successful, I think, due to your entrepreneurial drive and everything. In this podcast, we have a lot of would-be VC or young VCs who are trying to build their brand and presence in this very crowded and competitive market. Looking back, what are some of the, like, the maybe two or three, you know, key strategy for you that worked well, that, you know, to build a brand in such a short time?
Yeah, I think the common advice, which I mostly agree with, is pick a niche, just like pick one certain category that you know a lot about, so you're not making things up. That's important, but also so that it's not a lot of work. So you all probably have one topic that you're just experts on, and you could talk about it for an hour or write a blog post on the spot. Pick something like that where you don't really have to do a lot of research, because I think the one thing a lot of people don't talk about is burnout when it comes to creating content online. It's really hard to be consistent. So I just kind of picked topics that I didn't really have to do a whole lot of work on, or I was just already kind of naturally interested and already following.
What was it? Consumer?
Yeah, just like consumer tech.
A lot of social, right? I think you had posts on like ByteDance. You mentioned Snapchat, but yeah.
So one of the things I did was the day that Musical.ly rebranded as TikTok, they kind of started their marketing campaign. I downloaded and started using it, and I just remember thinking, this is the best app I've ever used. This is amazing. And so I was using it from a personal perspective. Like, this is a really good app. Like, and it's getting better every day. Like, you could tell. And I was also like, wow, what's this company ByteDance that owns it? Like, SoftBank just gave them $3 billion. Their ads are like, I was just kind of fascinated by it. So I just picked things I was naturally interested in.
I see.
And also it was mostly things other people weren't talking about. So you kind of pick a certain category or topic that's almost undercovered. So you probably see this like with the AI boom that happened over the last 6 months, like the first couple people that really honed in on it and kind of owned that topic became the experts on it, whether that was justified or not. Like, those are the people that we think are the experts. So
I think there's like 10 AI guys on Twitter right now.
Yeah. I think there's probably like 10 newsletters where they're the largest, fastest growing AI.
It's the fastest growing.
Newsletter. Yeah. So by the way, that's like it's a good strategy. Like, those people are probably always, I'm sure we all wish that we had the fastest growing AI newsletter, right? So I would generally just say, like, pick a topic or category that's kind of undercovered, but also you're kind of making a bet on it. Like, if you were to come out and start, let's say in 2022, start tweeting a lot about crypto and Web3, like, maybe that was not quite as, like, you should have picked AI in 22,
right?
Or you should have picked crypto in 2020 or 2018. Right. So I think the timing of these things is kind of important too. So it kind of shows, like, if you're trying to become an investor, get into VC, you're like, the things that you choose to talk about, like, that's kind of your track record.
Right.
Yes.
And then I kind of always thought about what are founders interested in? So that was another part of my content. And I just kind of realized there's all a ton of content on how to make your pitch deck, how to approach a VC, send a cold email. Like, here's all the metrics. I just didn't think I was going to really add much to the conversation. And it was hard to stand out. So most of my stuff was kind of related content, more so on broader, like, trends, markets, publicly traded companies, because for whatever reason, there's just fewer tech people talking about that, even though that's what we're all trying to do. We're all trying to build big, enduring, sustainable businesses. And then the other thing I kind of realized was with memes, where just everyone takes themselves very seriously. But if you just look at on social media, what most people use it for, like, memes are way more popular than anyone would really admit. And I think I saw a statistic. It said that on Instagram, memes are shared about 7 times more than non-meme content.
That's interesting.
So I was kind of thinking through, like, man, that's why they go so viral. and I kind of saw it when I would make funny content, it would just kind of rip through the algorithm, and like it would just, like, everyone would see it. So I don't know if that's necessarily the best strategy to use now, today.
Right.
But it was probably like 3 or 4 years ago when I kind of started doing it. And so it's like picking things that are the content you're writing about is almost like you're investing in that category.
Yeah.
Right. So,
yeah, that idea is a core of investment, you know, like non-consensus and right. So you need to be like right. And then picking an idea is like very interesting and very like, it's the same thing as an investment, as you say.
Yeah. And I think that the overarching theme is like you want to attract founders. That's really all that matters. So I think where a lot of people struggle is they try to seem like they're an expert on something. And that's not necessarily what founders need. Like, I think you probably shouldn't be investing in a company if you know more about it than the founder does. Like, they should know more about their specific market or product than you do. So I just kind of had this realization. I was like, I'm never going to be smarter than any of these founders. Like, maybe I understand more about the venture market and fundraising and like what the Fed is doing or something. Like, maybe that's where I know more than the founders do. But you're never going to like show up to a pitch and impress a founder like, man, that guy's so much smarter than me. and it's ultimately just about building trust. And will they do they trust you to work with you and take your money over someone else's? So for me, that was a big thing. Was I just kind of realized that it was like the type of content I was creating, and then like the format of using humor was a way to kind of like break down barriers. It's not going to work for every founder, but surprisingly, it worked with more founders than I thought that it would. And again, it's just like you're kind of finding undervalued channels and distribution to get in front of these people. So
you've talked about how, you know, the meme strategy, for example, it was probably the correct one to do, you know, two years ago, for example. I think timing is super important. You know, there's been a lot of fund managers, especially on the emerging fund manager side, for the past, you know, 2-3 years, that have built funds around content, right? Like Packy from Not Boring, you know, Harry from 20VC, they're amazing fund managers. Do you think, you know, the space has gotten a little bit more competitive? Do you think that, you know, the dynamic of, you know, the differentiation factor of content and distribution, has that kind of changed? Is that less kind of a value add now? Is it, or is it more just, you know, it's value add because it kind of creates that trust factor?
Yeah, I think it really just depends. I think generally it's slightly more competitive. Like it's mm-hmm. slightly less effective than it was.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think in 2021, everyone was reading Substacks and newsletters right. all day, and maybe they're doing it less so now. So it's mm-hmm. it's just less effective in 23 than it was, you know, two right. or 3 years ago. But imagine not doing those things. Like right. it's generally more effective than not doing them.
Right.
And again, that's where I could just kind of come back to. You probably, if you pick the right topics, categories, the right channels, like maybe podcasts on Instagram as a distribution channel is super undervalued, or using Pinterest or something. Okay. That's probably not true. And actually right now, I think probably using YouTube and Shorts is probably mm-hmm. one of the most, and this is for US VCs, but it's probably right. the most mm-hmm. undervalued. I just mm-hmm. kind of think about like supply and demand of attention and then what and where the audience is. So I've always kind of used TikTok, but I've mm-hmm. never really focused too much on there in terms of content because there's just fewer founders. They're mostly right. on Twitter. Most of right. the VCs mm-hmm. and founders are going to be on Twitter. So that was kind of always where I focused. But I think in terms of starting content, a lot of it is on the growth and just brand side, mm-hmm. like visibility. So understanding the algorithms and how they work. And I hate the word growth hacking, but it's probably important to realize what's going to elevate you and get you in front of people. So for example, they open sourced the Twitter algorithm, and it was, there's a couple things in there that were helpful for me to understand, but I kind of knew how important likes were from big accounts. Right. Mm-hmm. I realized I upgraded to Twitter Blue. I mm-hmm. didn't think I ever would, but I realized I just kept seeing these Twitter Blue accounts in the feed that were like right. bad tweets. And I just knew, and I'm kind of in group chats with a couple other content creators, and we figured out that people with Twitter Blue were being elevated in the algorithm. And it turns out they open source, and it's like, yeah, you get elevated yeah. when you have Twitter Blue. So it's almost like thinking about those kind of things too. Like you're almost like a founder. You're like trying to navigate right. your like yeah. growth, right? So,
right.
And then that's helpful too with founders. Like you can have those conversations. You're like, wow, how right. did you get your YouTube account, your TikTok, your newsletter? Right. Like that's probably how they're getting a lot of customers, at least, early on. Or even later, like they're picking different channels. So
right.
I think just being able to have a conversation with a founder about how YouTube Shorts growth might work, or what works and doesn't work on LinkedIn, Twitter, wherever they're getting their customers. Like that can be a pretty valuable conversation.
Mm. Makes sense.
So, and it's never the only thing. Like I never right. think just coming out and saying I have a bunch of people that follow me on Twitter, that's my value add, like never talk to me again. Like that's not going to swing it, but it's definitely a way right. to just kind of stand out, make people take the call. And then you kind of have to prove the worth to the founder from there. But
yeah. And let's talk a little bit about a little bit deep dive into the fund. Do want to talk about kind of your LPs and kind of how you work with them as well. But first, in terms of like sourcing deals, like you were pretty early on in like Be Real and in a lot of, you know, fast growing consumer startups. Like, how did you find them? Especially, you know, you have to find them online. Like, you know, what is the best way that you have found? Is it through intros? Is it, you know, you kind of proactively going out there? Is it kind of, you know, some funds use, you know, like some software to do it, right? What's kind of the secret with Banana, as much as you can say?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say the whole thing. I learned how to code when I was in eighth grade. I learned HTML, CSS, PHP, barely remember any of it. I got a C+ in my C+ class. So don't know any engineering. No proprietary software whatsoever. my thought on the software side, I think if you're just using just data signals, like you kind of, everyone builds the same thing. Like there's a lot of funds right. that pitch being data driven, and I think it's definitely helpful, but I just don't know. Like there's going to be a lot of other funds that are kind of doing the same thing. Right. So for me, a lot of it is, I think ahead of time you ask a question, what's my mix of inbound versus outbound?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. It's probably about 80% inbound and maybe 20% outbound. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the outbound is like somebody tells me about something and then I reach out. I don't know right. what you consider that. But I just get a lot of inbound, so I don't spend a ton of time on outbound, which is good. Like I don't have a big fund, so right. it's not like I'm trying to you know, I have a bunch of employees and analysts, like you need to hit quotas of how many people you reach out to. It's kind of constant inbound, which is, it's great. It's an awesome problem to have, but it's definitely not easy to do. It's just kind of a function of all the stuff that we talked about.
Do you want to change that though? Cause like I've talked to a lot of VCs. Obviously the more high brand VCs tend to get more inbound, but yep. A lot of them, you know, they want to do more outbound because they want to be able to like pick and choose, you know, the companies that they really want to invest in. Is the 80-20 kind of balance okay for you? You know? Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's okay. I mean, honestly, I would love if it's 100% inbound and it's the first investor they reach out to or talk right. to, like that's right. that's ultimately probably the best. Sure. So that's when I think about everything that I do, is just, can I have a founder, they're going to build a publicly traded company, will they reach out to me first? Like that's really all I think about. And I also, since I'm not like a big asset management firm, I'm not trying to invest in hundreds of companies every year, I'm not trying to see everything. Really, the way that a true venture fund works, you just need like one good investment every fund. Obviously, it's kind of scary to have one company where everything's riding on, but
right,
like it's okay if you just, if one investment per year worked, right? Yeah. Like maybe every 3 years, one goes public, every other year, something gets acquired for $1 billion. Like with just a traditional venture fund, like that's pretty good. So I don't worry too much about, am I seeing everything? I just like to make sure when I'm actually investing, do I have conviction in it? And do I think that the dollars I'm putting to work are going to get the required returns I need to on the fund? So, and that's where I kind of think about just early as possible. Like if you invest in the valuations have gone up for sure. We're talking to a founder, it's like 4 million pre-money, which is very low for pre-seed in the US.
Yep.
And I think it will monetize pretty well. So again, it's like that outcome can be $200, $300, $400 million, and it might return our fund depending on how big the check size is.
Right.
And that's not going to show up on any list of like top 100 VC right. startup investments, especially the way that the US landscape has evolved. Some of these funds, a $10 billion outcome will barely return your fund because some of these funds are so big. Yeah, I think I will probably always do a little bit of outbound, and you know, we just try to invest as early as possible. There'll be cases where, you know, we'll do a small check in like a Series A or B or C, or if we're following on when we're raising an SPV, it's just like a little bit different, the math. But yeah, we generally, I would actually prefer all inbound as early as possible, the very first conversation. And I think that's impossible, but that's the, right. That would be the goal.
How did it find the right fund size as a solo GP? If you don't have any constraint, what size would you choose for a solo GP?
That's a good question. So the fund size that I chose was just how much do I think I can raise efficiently without spending a ton of time on fundraising, which obviously that's probably not even possible in 2023 as an emerging manager with zero DPI. I guess technically I've had like some small exits that are, I've like recycled no cash return to investors. It's probably like around 100 million or 200 million maybe. And then probably have LPs that are interested in like SPVs. Like I think kind of the way I think about it and kind of what I would love to be able to pitch to a founder is be the very first investor and lead every round until you go public. And maybe I still invest after you go public. That's a little bit of an extreme case, but and so obviously you have a fund where in the beginning when it's hard to raise an SPV, like it's hard to go to LPs and say, hey, I want to raise $5 million to invest in this one single company that there's nothing yet. And maybe the founder isn't even that impressive on paper. So it would take me months to raise this money, give them the cash. They start building something. As they progress, it's like, oh, this is actually a business. Okay, we can pitch it to other investors, have them come in to the SPV, and maybe it's 10 million, 20, 50, 100. Like, I don't know how much you raise throughout the course. But I think I like to be able to think each fund could be a 10X. And I just think, and it's probably not going to happen. I'll probably have tons of funds that are not that. But I think once you go above 100 million, it just gets hard. So it's still possible, but it's just, I like to not have it be too stressful where I'm, I like to be able to work collaboratively with the founders too. And you know, it's like if you're fine, I think there's probably a sweet spot somewhere around 100 million. Maybe it's 80, maybe it's 130 million. I'm not really sure. And I guess I haven't, I don't know where the market will settle either. Like as you know, VC dollars deployed comes down a little bit. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of ways to play with them. I think it's small-ish, kind of normal-sized early stage fund, and then just being able to do SPVs to support the founders as they need it.
Mm. I see. When you pitch to LPs, of course, you know, you want to provide them the potential for the maximum return. That's the first and foremost. But there are some like strategic LPs who are looking for like something extra. Do you have plans to provide like industry landscapes or some insights to your LPs in your new fund?
Possibly. I would probably need more people on the team to help me.
I see.
Produce those. I do write a newsletter that is mostly serious, and it's mostly just kind of sharing interesting things that I've come across. Once a week, I'll usually go deep on one topic that's like 3 to 10 paragraphs, or I might do a deep dive on a portfolio company that's maybe 1,000 words or 2,000 words. And maybe that's kind of like a landscape.
And this is mostly on the consumer space, I assume.
Mostly, yeah. I just don't think I'm smart enough about SaaS or like space investing or deep tech to like really even know what I'm talking about.
So, it's impossible to cover everything.
Yeah. So I think, and so also strategically on the consumer side, I just felt like less VCs were doing that. Like most VCs were talking about SaaS. Most VCs are like right now, most VCs are talking about AI and like in the US defense and like national security is like a big thing. And I don't know anything about that stuff. And other people are talking about it. So I'm not really going to stand out in any way. So it kind of always comes back to just how can I maximize the ROI of the time spent in terms of just differentiation, like the open lanes and like content or branding or, you know, like humor, kind of all that kind of stuff. So,
I mean, I think the newsletter serves kind of that kind of industry type purpose, I think. For example, like Temu, right? Like the Pinduoduo app. Like, I think I first learned about it on Twitter, but then you did a deep dive very early on about it, right? And so, like, I think in that sense, like, there's a lot of insight that you can just get from subscribing to the newsletter. So
it was before they launched. I was like, oh, Pinduoduo, second largest e-commerce platform in China. They have a lot of resources. They're gonna probably build something similar in the U.S. Here's what I think they might do. This is before they even launched, and they've been number one in the App Store. Within like a month, they hit number one, and they've been number one since then. And I wrote about it like 3 times right in the beginning, and it was just kind of sharing my thoughts. And I don't even really think about it anymore. It's like, oh, cool, they're the number one. I'm on to the next thing. Yeah. I don't really use it. It's kind of like it's a product for low-income consumers to buy like $1 and $3 items. It's probably a great business, and it's a great product for the people that it serves, but I don't really use it, but I kind of try to use the newsletter as like almost like a diary, I guess. Not really, but it's kind of just a way to put my thoughts out there and things I'm following. So that's definitely a way. A couple of LPs have said they like reading it just to see what I'm thinking about. So
yeah, and then how have you built kind of your relationship with LPs? Like, you know, how do you work with them? And then like all of our listeners are from Japan, so are you open to having like Japanese LPs?
Yeah, I'm definitely open to it. I think I do have one Japanese LP. I have a couple from a couple different countries outside the U.S. Most continents except Africa. I don't, and maybe LATAM. I don't actually know where the person lives. The entity might have been a U.S. entity, but yeah, it's a little bit of everything. I have a family offices, fund of funds, founders that have exited. Corporations, no life insurance companies, no pensions or endowments, like some no like nonprofits, but have had conversations with a lot of those people. So I think it kind of fits the whole spectrum of there's some people that have never responded to me since they invested like 3 years ago or 2 years ago. And then there's some people that I talk to on average of like once a month. So it really just depends. I probably lean more towards the lower maintenance, just like don't have a lot of questions, trust what I'm doing, always happy to have conversations and chat with them about things, but it's more so that they just trust me and I'm doing the right thing. So it's definitely where I'm open to a lot. But I think kind of the dream scenario is probably 10 large LPs, and then we're able to do some SPVs to kind of follow on over time. And that will probably take me 10, 20, 30 years to get there, right? Like it's not a quick thing. It's a long time to meet those people, build trust and all that stuff. Absolutely. So.
Cool. Well, I think we're almost out of time. Last question from my side. It's about the name. So you started Banana Capital in 2021. Your wife actually came up with the name. I think it was she was thinking about kind of Apple and then thinking how you can have another fruit name.
Yep.
And I think the point that I think you had made, I think it was in a conversation with Lee, was you can own an emoji, right? And like that was, I think, super powerful, and it like completely fit the brand as well with the kind of the memes. You know, there's a bunch of people here listening on the podcast that, you know, are thinking about creating a VC or thinking about like rebranding, different things like that. What is kind of the factors that come into kind of coming up with a good name?
Yeah, I think
for a VC fund.
For a VC fund. So if you've ever tried to come up with a name for a company or a VC fund, like they all exist. Every single word is taken.
Yeah.
Like Red River Ventures, Blue Crest Capital, like Sequoia Benchmark, like all these words that sound like good phrases or words for an investment firm. And it's crazy when you get into real estate too. Like there's hundreds of thousands of real estate firms. Like you think there's a lot of venture firms, it's all these names are taken. So yeah, we were like thinking one day and we're just like, we just need crazy ideas. Like it's all that's left. My wife said, well, Apple's the most valuable company in the world. What about a fruit? And I was like, oh yeah, that's actually a really good idea. What about banana? And like I said, I was thinking about something that really popped and stood out. So banana, it's kind of weird. Maybe it's legit. Like there's a fund in the US called Pear. There's one in Europe called Cherry. One word is usually pretty good if you can own the word. And I thought banana, that's kind of serious, but it's also kind of funny. Like it's also kind of a meme. Yes. So it kind of fits the brand. And then I also thought it was important to try to find an emoji and own an emoji. And there's a banana emoji. So the emoji that we kind of use is the banana emoji and then the cap, like the little hat emoji, banana cap. So that was really the thinking behind it. And I just kind of feel like in an area or in a time of short attention spans, like you got to do things that capture people's attention quick and is memorable. So that was kind of the thinking. And it's kind of ridiculous too. Like you hear the fun name Banana Capital. You're like, what? Is that real? Like, is it a joke? So it always stands out. And people, I think, and again, it all comes back to founders. Like the founders care about it. And usually, you know, we get a lot of comments on that's a really interesting, fun name. Like I like the name. So.
Yeah, it's definitely like it sounds very friendly, like compared to like other fruits, like Watermelon Capital. Banana sounds like more like friendly.
Yeah, it's definitely like a funny fruit. Yes.
Yeah.
And it's definitely not like on a SaaS or deep tech fund.
Yeah, exactly.
It's definitely consumer fund.
It's not AI. It's
no,
not AI.
No.
Yeah,
it can be AI though.
Yeah,
it can be AI.
If we do deep tech, we'll have to figure like raspberry maybe or like a different fruit. Like what's like a serious fruit? Or like it's like a space fund. Like what would be a space? I don't know. Actually, sending monkeys to space, like banana. So maybe banana is good for deep tech.
Well, Turner, it's been great to have you on. Do you have any kind of final word of advice or final kind of message that you want to talk about? You know, where can people find you? Where can people find Banana Capital? How can they reach out?
Yeah, where can they find me? How can they reach out? I'm pretty active on Twitter. If you just Google my name, is Google the primary search engine in Japan?
Google, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so if you just Google my name, I think my Twitter will show up, and then I write.
We'll put the Twitter bio in the description.
Amazing. So Twitter, I read most of my email as long as it doesn't go to spam. My email is on our website. It's just turner@bananacapital.vc. I write my newsletter. It's The Split, and it's www.thesplit, and it's .it, so spull.it. A little bit weird, but that's like I said, you're trying to come up with names, domains that work. Like that's how it worked. That's the newsletter that I write about once a week. And then that's probably the best place to find me. Try to be pretty active online and just try to have fun. So it's usually, hopefully it's entertaining if you follow along. So
definitely. Well, I mean, I'm subscribed to the newsletter to you on Twitter. And then, you know, we've emailed a bunch of times back and forth. So definitely a huge fan. Turner, thanks for coming on. We'll do a follow up where we talk about kind of this conversation in Japanese. It's great having you on, and best of luck.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.